the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Great. Let's read together, shall we, from the Gospel of Matthew. We're going through the whole Gospel in the course of the year, as you know, and we've reached the end of our second section here. So it's rather a long reading from chapter 9 and verse 35, right to the end of chapter 10. So it's a good job you've got a Scottish preacher that can talk fairly fast. Okay, let's read it together anyway, shall we? Let's read through the section and then we'll say a few things about it. Jesus went through all the towns and... Oh, by the way, this is page 922, if you haven't found it yet. Page 922, Matthew chapter 9, verse 35. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and illness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." Jesus called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and illness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and his brother Andrew. James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. Philip and Bartholomew. Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. James, son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus. Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: "Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. As you go, proclaim this message: the kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal those who are ill, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. Do not get any gold or silver or copper to take with you in your belts, no bag for the journey or extra shirt or sandals or a staff. For workers are worth their keep. Whatever town or village you enter, search for some worthy person there and stay at that person's house until you leave. As you enter the home, give it your greeting. If the home is deserving, let your peace rest on it. If it is not, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. Truly I tell you, it will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Be on your guard. You'll be handed over to the local councils and be flogged in the synagogues. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. But when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you'll be given what to say, for it will not be you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. Everyone will hate you because of me. But those who stand firm to the end will be saved. When you're persecuted in one place, flee to another. Truly, I tell you, you will not finish going through the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Students are not above their teacher, nor servants above their master. It is enough for students to be like their teacher and servants like their master. If the head of the house has been called Beelzebul, how much more the members of his household? So, do not be afraid of them. There's nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your Father's care. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Whoever publicly acknowledges me, I will also acknowledge before my Father in heaven. But whoever publicly disowns me, I will disown before my Father in heaven. Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword, for I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies will be the members of your own household. Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves a son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Anyone who welcomes you welcomes me, and anyone who welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. Whoever welcomes someone known to be a prophet will receive a prophet's reward, and whoever welcomes someone known to be righteous will receive a righteous person's reward. And if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones who is known to be my disciple, truly I tell you, that person will certainly be rewarded. Well, there's much more than we can possibly talk about in this passage tonight, but we want to focus in on just one thing. Christianity is a mission religion. In fact, the mission religion, when you think about it. None of the great religions of the world have had mission at their heart as much as Christianity has. I suppose that's pretty obvious if you look at them. Islam starts with a proclamation from God. Buddhism starts with an insight that somebody got by sitting in his own for a very long time. Hinduism starts with traditions. Christianity starts with good news. And because it's news, it has to be shared around right from the start. Part of the deal in being a Christian is you're part of God's mission in the world. And so it's not surprising as you work through Matthew's Gospel to find that after you've read just about a quarter of it, just slightly more than a quarter, you've already got Jesus, who's only just come to fame himself, if you like, already sending out his disciples. Now, when you think how they acted a couple of years later, when Jesus was tried and crucified, how little they understood. How unclear their minds were about exactly who he was and what he was supposed to be doing. He was taking a terrible risk, wasn't he? But that's Christianity for you. It's a mission religion. Now, obviously what they weren't doing here was preaching the gospel in the way that we preach it nowadays. There were two big things still to happen, namely the cross and the resurrection, before that would be possible. So what were they doing? Well, I guess what they were doing was preparing the ground. You see, after Jesus died, after the day of Pentecost, the church took off in Jerusalem and Judea and up in Galilee in a way that had never been seen before. Why did that happen? Because the ground was prepared. Because Jesus had sent out his disciples to do a bit of, I suppose you could say, suspense advertising. Look at the message they've got here. The kingdom of God is near. The kingdom of God has come very close to you. There is something coming which is so big, so staggering, that if we told you about it, assuming we understood it, which we don't, you wouldn't understand it yourselves. All we can say is, watch this space. And in the meantime, we're doing miracles, we're casting out demons as a demonstration that the power of God is going to be focused in an amazing way all over this country. And as Jesus says, well, you won't get through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. And then he does die on the cross and he's risen again. And even in those towns that were reached, people suddenly start saying, this is what it was about. That's what those miracles were for. That's the meaning of those parables he told. Now it's starting to make sense. That challenge, let him who has ears to hear, let him hear. Now we've got ears, we can hear. And people become Christians right, left and centre. So what the disciples were doing here, even though it was a limited message and just for the Jews, only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, says Jesus, it was vital preparation for what was going to come on later. Christianity has always been a mission religion. Right at this point, this is not working. Why is it not working? Possibly because I got the wrong one. That could be it. Yep, that's the right one. Good. So we're one. Right at this moment, Jesus' mission is focused still in the north of the country, up in Galilee. This is where he's done all the work he's done so far in the chapters that we've traced through so far. This is where he's going to be, in fact, until chapter 20. In Matthew's version, most of his work is still up in the north, and he's sending his disciples out throughout that region. It's a region where there's a lot of poverty. There's a big difference between Galilee and Judea in those days. Judea, down towards Jerusalem, is relatively wealthy. It's hard to be really poor in Judea. Galilee, on the other hand, is a country of contrasts. There are some people who've done very, very well indeed. Galilee's a fertile place. And those who own the land, those who are the big landowners, vineyard owners, farmers, make money that the people down in Jerusalem envy. You can be a plutocrat up in Galilee, but you can also be very poor indeed. And when Jesus sees the crowds and realizes how little they have, how paltry are the hopes they've got for life, he has compassion on them and he says to his disciples, this harvest is massive, absolutely massive. I think there are six lessons you'll learn about mission from this chapter. There are actually quite a few more, but six I'm going to pick out anyway. First of all, mission's urgent. Second, mission's a privilege. Third, mission's strategic. Fourth, mission's possible, but fifth, mission's difficult. And finally, mission is obedience. I just want to look at those six lessons very, very quickly with you tonight. First of all, mission is urgent. This is where we start. Jesus says, the harvest is massive, but there are few laborers. Pray that the Lord of the harvest will send out other people into the harvest. He's reminding them of something that happened in the harvest of those days. In Galilee, he used to harvest right through from about April or May to almost December, with different crops on the way through. And landowners would need lots of people to come and work for them. Casual labourers that weren't employed by them all year round. And sometimes when you were trying to get the harvest in and the day was wearing on a bit and you realised you just weren't going to finish the field, it was important to go to the Lord of the harvest, the guy who was in charge of the process, the owner or the foreman, and say, Lord of the harvest, we need more workers. We can't do it this way. You're going to have to go down in the marketplace, get some more people, hire them. However you can do it, just get more people in there. That's the picture that Jesus is using here. The harvest is massive. And he's saying to the disciples, can't you see what's going on out there? Can't you see how little hope these people have? Pray that God will send more workers into the harvest field. And so the first thing he's challenging us to do is realize just how urgent mission actually is. It's not something we can take for granted. And often down through history, that's been the case with God's people. They've just assumed that, well, yes, it's part of our role, but maybe not this week. It's amazing, isn't it? That in the 16th century, you have this massive reformation that brings the gospel back to the center of European churches and just transforms lives across Europe. And the great mission movement of the church doesn't start for another 200 years. Incredible, really. But Christians were so concerned with building their own churches and sorting out their doctrines and fighting with one another between Calvinism and Arminianism that they weren't that bothered about China or India. And it took another generation, William Carey, Spener and Franke in Germany, suddenly to say, what about the rest of the world? What are we doing? Mission is the heart of what we are. And it's too easy for us to forget our priorities. Mission is urgent. And Jesus says the harvest is great, but the workers are few. Never use Christian mission as a field for advancing yourself. Never think the harvest is great, there are few workers, this is a chance for me to become big. I can fill all the gaps that nobody's filling. No, instead pray that God will put other people there as well as you to do the things that you can't do, to do better the things that you don't do very well. Pray that God will send out more workers and more and more. And the spirit of competition you sometimes see between churches and Christian workers is completely wrong, because we should be glad, we should be delighted, we should be exulting when other people go out into the harvest field. And Jesus is saying here, the harvest is urgent, mission is urgent. Rick Warren said this: if your neighbour had cancer or AIDS and you knew the cure, it would be criminal to withhold that life-saving information. Even worse would be to keep secret the way to forgiveness, purpose, peace and eternal life. We have the greatest news in the world, and sharing it is the greatest kindness you can show to anyone. Your mission has eternal significance. It will impact the eternal destiny of other people. So it's more important than any job, achievement or goal you reach during your life on earth. The consequences of your mission will last forever. Nothing else you do will ever matter as much as helping people establish an eternal relationship with God. And I guess over the last 20 years, we've been hit by two life events in this country which have helped to blunt the edge of mission. One has been the prosperity that lasted until a few years ago, when people's careers, when jobs, when achievement suddenly seemed very, very important indeed. And people started putting other goals in front of sharing the gospel. And then the recession and the difficulty that that's brought about, which has led to people saying, well, you know, I've got to do certain things. I've got to stay alive. I've got to survive. What Rick Warren says is there is nothing you can do with your life that's more important than sharing the gospel with fellow human beings. There's a great poem about the life of St. Paul, which is about three times as long as it needs to be, but a great 19th century poem which just puts some of the words of Paul in the New Testament into verse. And one stanza says this: only like souls I see the folk thereunder, bound who should conquer, slaves who should be kings. This is Paul looking at the non-Christian world of his day. Bound who should conquer, slaves who should be kings, hearing their one hope with an empty wonder, sadly contented in a show of things. There are people like that all around us. They're all over the school where I work. Then with a rush, the intolerable craving shivers throughout me like a trumpet call. Oh, to save those, to perish for their saving, die for their life, be offered for them all. And that's based on a passage where Paul says, I wish for the sake of my brethren, I were even cut off from God, just so that they could be saved. And Campbell Morgan, the great preacher, said, let commentators cease their foolish attempts to explain away those verses. In saying that, he says, Paul has come nearer to Jesus Christ here than ever before. This impulse of the Christ life, which wrought redemption for the race at the cost of his own life, enters a human soul and floods it to overflowing. Now, I don't know about you, but that challenges me. Have I ever been so gripped by the need of other people, by the desperate urgency of getting the message out to them, that it just floods through me and makes me willing to lose everything I've got just so that they can know Jesus? The mission is urgent. And the first question I want to ask is this: how concerned are you about the harvest? But let's move on. The second thing is that mission is a privilege. Jesus takes his followers and gives them authority to do the things that he's been doing. And he gives them all sorts of instructions. And in this passage you find all sorts of good things about them. First of all, they're sent. Do you notice how it stops calling them disciples and starts calling them apostles? Apostles comes from the word apostello, which means I send out. They've been people who've been commissioned. They've been given a special label. They've been sent out to do something for Jesus. They're given authority. They're told they can go and work in his name. They're agents of good news. They have to spread the message to everybody. They're resourced. Jesus says, don't worry about your needs. They'll be met. I'll make sure of that. They're protected. Don't worry about when they throw you into prison or when you have to stand in front of law trials. God values your life as more than that of many sparrows. They're bringers of Jesus too, because Jesus says, whoever receives you receives me. Wherever you go and you talk about me, I'm there. And if I'm there, then my Father's there as well. So you are actually ministering God to people. That's an incredible responsibility we've got, isn't it? And a massive, massive, massive privilege. So here's question two. If you've got the urgency of the mission at heart, do you really value the privilege of representing Jesus? Does it ever cross your mind when you wake up in the morning and think, coffee, I need coffee, or shower, I need a shower? Does it ever cross your mind to think, here's another day that God's put me into, where I have the privilege of going out and serving him, where it's possible I'll come across somebody who's never heard the good news before and I'll be able to explain it to them? Or where I'll be able to shift the attitudes of my friends or the people I work with just a little bit in the right direction? What an immense privilege. It could be that today something happens that's going to lead to somebody coming up to me in eternity and saying, it's you, it was down to you, you did it, I wouldn't be here without you. What a fantastic privilege every day brings when you see it like that. And so, because the harvest is so big, the third thing to say is this mission is also strategic. You've got to strategize where you're actually going. And so Jesus said to them, be careful where you go. You can't do everything at once. Who is the guy on the picture? Well, that's one of the greatest missionaries in the history of the world, James Hudson Taylor, the founder of the China Inland Mission. Before he came along in the 19th century, people had been trying to evangelize China for over 100 years. And you know what? They hadn't got very far. Why? Because all of the European trading posts were around the coast. And so the coast was over-evangelized. And lots of people had heard the message about Jesus along the coast, but the vast interior of China, teeming millions of people, had never heard the gospel. And so Hudson Taylor adopted a very unusual approach, as you can see from the fact that he's wearing Chinese clothes in the picture there. He persuaded some of the brightest and best university graduates of his day to join him, to grow their hair very long so they had a massive pigtail down their back. That was a very macho sign of virility in China, so you had to do that if you wanted to be respected. And then to go to China, not to start churches, not to lead people to Christ, but to go right throughout the whole of that inland area, just doing what the disciples are doing here, really, suspense advertising, telling people the story. Just getting the story of Jesus known around China. He said, don't stop and build churches. Other people will come and do that. Let's just tell the whole of China about Jesus. As a result, although he's not much known in Barnsley nowadays, the local town council have been stunned by the number of Chinese visitors who keep making a trip to the town to see where this great man actually came from. There's no memorial to him. I think his house has been torn down, the house he was born in, and most people in Barnsley have no idea who Hudson Taylor is. Millions of people throughout the Chinese-speaking world owe him tremendous gratitude. And it's been the case often throughout Christian history that strategizing, choosing where you're going has been important. David Livingstone in Africa, he's sometimes been criticized. Oh, well, you know, he didn't really lead many people to Christ, and he did more exploring. Maybe he was after glory and fame. You know, he found Victoria Falls and he penetrated into the heart of Africa. But actually, was he really interested in the gospel, or was he just an explorer at heart? No, you just need to read a few pages of Livingstone's writings. You just have to hear the reminiscences of people who knew him, and you realize here's somebody who was on fire for the gospel, but who realized that Africa had to be carved wide open. That until the center of Africa was mapped, until people had taken the gospel to remote places where it had never been before, there were never going to be churches, there were never going to be hospitals, there were never going to be converts. And so despite the fact he led very few people to Christ, he inspired a whole generation of missionaries who went all over that continent and changed the face of Africa in just a few years because he was thinking strategically. Now, that's what Jesus is doing with his disciples here, isn't it? Don't go to the Samaritans. Don't go to anybody but the lost house of Israel. Why is that? Well, if you look at where Galilee is, you'll see that down below it, there is Samaria, where the Samaritans live. They were people kind of half Jews. And they might have listened a little bit more sympathetically than some of the real Jewish people. You find in France nowadays, for instance, that many of the churches are making lots of converts amongst those who don't really feel they fit in French society. The Algerians, the Pieds-Noirs, the people who've come in as immigrants into France. The ethnic French are much more difficult to reach. And it would have been that way if the disciples had gone to the Samaritans. The Samaritans would have listened with great interest. And after Jesus died and rose again, you find the church in Samaria really taking off, don't you, very, very quickly in the book of Acts. The Gentiles might have listened with interest as well. And there were a couple of Gentile towns, not very far. Oops, hang on a minute, that's not what I wanted. Yes, it is. Go back. All right, there we go. Come on, do it. Behave. A couple of Gentile towns, very close to where Jesus was. There was the city of Tiberias, right on the Sea of Galilee, founded in honor of the Emperor Tiberius. So obviously no Jews were going to live there much. It was going to be a city for Gentiles, for people with some money who wanted a lakeside view. And there was a city of Sepphoris not far away. And that again was a Gentile city where Jesus himself had possibly worked as a craftsman. He lived just a mile down the road from it after all. But these Gentile implants were there, not very far away. And to take the gospel to the Gentiles, take this message to the Gentiles, might have been more interesting because, again, they weren't Jewish. And many of the Gentiles who were now living in Israel had become intrigued with Judaism. So the disciples might have found them easier to speak to. But Jesus said, no, your target is the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Don't be deflected. Choose the target. Choose where you're going to go very, very carefully indeed, because it's important that we hit the right targets first. It's possible for a church to keep on adding on activities right, left, and centre, trying to meet a need here, a need there, a need. Hey, we don't have a Bible study yet for left-handed Cuban bus conductors, or something like that. And you keep on adding on activities on top of activities, and the whole end result is your energies are dissipated in a million different directions. What you've got to do sometimes is look at who you're supposed to be ministering to and say, who is the strategic group? Not because you want to focus on them to the exclusion of anybody else. You can't say ever, no, push off, you're not the right ethnic group, you're not the right income bracket, we're not ministering to you. No, of course not. But there are people who will be a gateway to others. So you start in the strategic place, you start in the important place, and you go on to the rest of the world from there. That can be true in our own lives too. Who are the strategic people for you and me? All of that thinking we've done about the front line in the last few years is desperately important here, isn't it? Who are the people that God really wants to use you with? They won't necessarily be the people that first come to mind. They won't necessarily be the people that you spend most time to. In fact, I think the members of your own family are sometimes the most difficult to talk to about Jesus. But you've got a front line out there, and you've got people on it who are strategic and important. How are you going to strategize your activities so that you're spending time with them, so that you're hitting those targets, so that your mission is strategic? And that's the third question. Where's your strategic place in the harvest process? Three more points to make. Fourth, mission is possible. This is important. Anybody can do it. Jesus is talking to a bunch of people, one of whom is going to betray him later on, and saying, you guys can do it. I trust you. You can go out there and you will do these things, powerful things, in my name. It's not impossible. And I think one of the things that the devil uses to cripple our mission more than anything else is this idea that you can't do it. You're hopeless. Other people might be able to. You can't. Who's this guy? Well, this is David Shepherd, who was one of England's great test cricketers in the days when England used to win. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. No, okay. But he was. This is him at the wicket in 1954, which tells you how far back that goes. But he was somebody who hit the headlines because he was not only a very, very successful test cricketer, he also became a Christian. And when he left university, went into a pioneering mission in the East End of London, that ended up with him becoming a bishop, and a very powerful, godly and wonderful bishop as well. I worked with him just once, and it's one of the most precious memories I've got. How did David Shepherd become a Christian? He was obsessed with sport. He had a good life. He was a Cambridge student who seemed to have everything going for him. He had no interest in religion and no religious background. Well, he became a Christian because of this guy. This is David Watson, who was later on the minister of a church in York and one of the most powerful evangelists in British history. But he was just a little Christian in Cambridge in the days when David Shepherd was already making a name for himself as a cricketer. And one day, Watson met Shepherd in the quad. They were members of the same college, and said, would you like to come round to tea tomorrow? And Shepherd, intrigued by this invitation from somebody he hardly knew, said, yeah, okay. And when he turned up, he said it was almost laughable. Because clearly, David Watson, who had no interest in sport whatsoever, had spent the last 24 hours just mugging up everything he could about cricket to make the conversation flow. And it was pathetic, because you could see in 30 seconds he didn't know what he was talking about at all. And that so impressed Shepherd that that guy would go to so much trouble just to get to talk to him that he thought he must have something really important to say to me. And so, despite the fact that David Watson's effort was pretty pathetic, David Shepherd became a Christian. And that's the way that God can use it. Sometimes it won't be through the power or the strength or the abilities that you have, through the mistakes you make. But God can use it. Mission is possible. And so the question here, very simply, is how much do you believe God can truly use you in the harvest? But that's not to say it's going to be easy. Because the fifth thing in this chapter is that mission is difficult. And Jesus warns about that over and over, doesn't he, as you read those verses. There will be people who will stand up against you. You'll be taken into court. People will try to kill you because of my name. You go to some towns and you'll think you're going to stay in a good place, and they'll turn out to be a bad place after all. You'll have to shake the dust of your shoes, the dust of that town off your shoes as you leave. What's that all about? Well, often in those days, if a Jew went to a Gentile town, because he had to go there for trade reasons or something like that, he would show how good a Jew he was by stopping at the 30 sign on the way out and taking his shoes off his feet and shaking the dust off violently so that everybody could see that he had nothing to do with the Gentiles any longer. And for you to do that as a Jew on the edge of a Jewish town would be quite something. It would be one bunch of Jews saying, we are nothing to do with you. You've refused our message. You didn't want to listen. So we're not going to water it down. We're not going to make a deal with you. We're not going to compromise. We're just going to go away. Jesus never compromised. Think of the rich young ruler. as he turned away from Jesus, crestfallen, and walked away in the opposite direction, it says that Jesus, looking after him, loved him. He felt a surge of pity and compassion, real desire to see that young man in his kingdom. And what did he do? He didn't move a muscle to bring him back. He let him walk away. You cannot water down the message of the gospel. Mission can be difficult sometimes. A.W. Tozer, the great preacher of the 1950s, said this: "We who preach the gospel must not think of ourselves as public relations agents sent to establish goodwill between Christ and the world. We must not imagine ourselves commissioned to make Christ acceptable to big business, the press, the world of sports, or modern education. We're not diplomats, but prophets, and our message is not a compromise, but an ultimatum." How much are we willing to say unpopular things, to be unpopular, because we stand faithfully for something that the world doesn't want to hear? How far are you prepared to brave ridicule and misunderstanding for the harvest? I guess it's that that puts more of us off saying things when we get a chance than anything else, isn't it? How far are you prepared to go? One final question then, and we're done. Mission is obedience. This is what Jesus is saying at the end. Oops, hang on a second. Oops, wrong one. That's us. This is what Jesus is saying at the end when he says, "Listen, anyone who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves a son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Now, there's nothing wrong with those affections, and it's often been pointed out that Jesus loved his own family, and he wasn't denying that these are valid and important relationships in their lives. But he was saying, your commitment to me has got to be overriding. It's got to come first. If it's ever a shootout between those two loves, your love for me has got to be the most important thing. And you've got to take up your cross and follow me. What does it mean to take up your cross? Well, it means you're prepared to die to yourself. You're prepared to die to your own ambitions, die to your own comfort, die to your own priorities, so that he can come first. And it's only in that way that our mission is going to be effective and successful. So the final question is, what's mission for you? An infrequent hobby or the very business of your life? Let me quote in closing one more time A.W. Tozer. He said this when he was talking about the fact that we've redefined the cross in many ways nowadays, but you can't redefine it. It's got to stay right at the centre of where we are. We must do something about the cross, he says, and one of two things only we can do: flee it or die upon it. If we're wise, we'll do what Jesus did: endure the cross and despise the shame for the joy that's set before us. To do this is to submit the whole pattern of our lives to be destroyed and built again in the power of an endless life. The cross will cut into where it hurts worst, sparing neither us nor our carefully cultivated reputations. It will defeat us and bring our selfish lives to an end. Only then can we rise in fullness of life to establish a pattern of living wholly new and free and full of good works. And I just wonder if there are things that you and I need to bring to the cross tonight and die to, so that the mission can go ahead. Let me just, in closing, ask you those questions once again. How concerned are you about the harvest? And if you share a little bit of Jesus' heart for the harvest, do you really value the privilege of representing Jesus? And if that's the case, where's your strategic place in the harvest process? When you've got that sorted out, how much do you believe that God can truly use you in the harvest? Are you prepared for the difficulties? How far are you prepared to brave ridicule and misunderstanding for the harvest? And then finally, what's mission for you? An infrequent hobby or the business of your life? Jesus says, if you're my disciple, then following me means following in mission.